The Talmud teaches us, it's a famous passage in the tractate, in the volume called Yuma, which deals with Yom Kippur, that the second holy temple, the second temple in Jerusalem, was destroyed because of what the Talmud refers to as sinat chinam, baseless hatred between Jews. And the Netziv, who was a great Talmudic and rabbinic scholar, in his introduction to the book of Genesis, writes that what was typical of that generation when the temple was destroyed was that the people didn't tolerate any differences. That somehow, if there are any differences between Jews, they were not tolerated, and they would label people with whom they disagreed as heretics. And because of that intolerance, we're told that our temple was destroyed. And that to this day, 2,000 years later, we still suffer from the same malady. The Chafetz Chaim, who was one of the great rabbinic leaders of the early 20th century, wrote a letter in the year 1930 that was published in Jerusalem. He writes, "I must speak out my heart about the manner of conflict taking place among the Jewish people. One camp publicizes its view in the newspapers with the signatures of all of its backers. The other side does the same. One of them wrote that the one with the most signatures wins. And I say, the one with the most signatures is creating unnecessary conflict in Israel. All of Israel is burning like a fire as each side places more and more ads in the newspaper condemning their opposition. Even the Holy Land of Israel has become a subject of controversy. I don't know who permitted all of these terrible sins. Everyone is sure that they are saying the truth. And it's the other opinion which is creating the argument. This is a grave error, because even if they are right, they have no right to violate the Torah. So many commandments are being violated by this dispute. No good can possibly come out of this. Right or wrong, they're creating a desecration of God's holy name. 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva died in 1 month, not because they argued, but because they argued improperly and caused the desecration of God's name. And certainly each of these giants felt that they were right." So the challenge that I would like to really discuss tonight is, how do we relate to those people, those groups of Jews, and those individuals with whom we differ? How do we relate to people with whom we differ? How do we live in unity while disagreeing? How do we stand up for our beliefs, yet respect those who disagree with us? That's really the challenge for tonight's talk. It's important to clarify at the beginning, and I think everyone understands this, that there are limits to pluralism, meaning that no one would say that everything goes. Right? We all understand that Judaism has its parameters, and while each of us might draw the line at some point, we all understand that the line has to be drawn. For example, the entire Jewish community basically would say today that Jews for Jesus is beyond the pale. Right? That's not an acceptable option within Judaism. And yet we know that before we get that far, right, there are plenty of other issues that divide us as Jews. So when the Netziv wrote in his introduction to the book of Genesis that at the time of the Second Temple, people disagreed with each other and called each other heretics, he was referring to people who were actually all within the pale, so to speak, because the Netziv himself writes that you don't have to tolerate people whose opinions lie outside of the parameters of Judaism. So there are really two parts to tonight's talk. One is, how do we deal with those opinions and individuals and groups who lie within the pale of Judaism? We would consider their opinions within the realm of Judaism, but we disagree with them very sharply. We have differences of opinion among ourselves. And then, I think more problematic, more delicate problem, how do we relate and deal with those people among the Jewish community who we feel are practicing and believing ideas and practices outside of the parameters of Judaism. One of the things I think we need to begin with tonight is the idea that the Torah itself assumes that people are different. It's almost an axiom of the Torah that not everyone is the same. The Netziv, who we quoted before, says in his introduction to the book of Genesis that the sin of the Tower of Babel, right, early on in the book of Genesis, was that they all were, that the Bible says, of Dvarim Ahadim. They all basically had one speech. They didn't tolerate any differences between each other. They demanded everyone toe the same party line. And so what did God do? We're told that God didn't want them to all have the same speech. God multiplied their languages. God scattered them to restore diversity. Right? It wasn't considered healthy to have all people being exactly the same. We know that the Talmud tells us that just as everyone's face is different, no two people have the same face, so too the rabbis teach us that no two people have the same way of thinking. Right? We're individuals, we're different, we're not homogenized. And the Holy Kutzker Rebbe used to say, if I am I because you are you, and you are you because I am I, then I am not I and you are not you. But if you are you because you are you, and I am I because I am I, then I am I and you are you. Understand? We all know that in our prayers, we say in the beginning of the Amidah, the Shemona Esrei, right, we address our prayers to Elohei Abraham, Elohei Yitzchak, Elohei Yaakov, to the God of Abraham, to the God of Isaac, to the God of Jacob. So the obvious question is, why didn't the prayer book save a few words and simply say that we are praying to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Right? To the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Why the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob? And the rabbis explain that each one of our patriarchs had their own relationship with God. They didn't all walk in the same exact way. They each carved out for themselves an individual, personal, private, if you will, relationship with God. We're told that when the Jewish people crossed the Red Sea, when they came out of Egypt, there wasn't one lane that opened up when the sea split. The rabbis teach us that 12 different lanes opened up because each tribe had their particular lane that they went through. And in the same way that we had 12 lanes for the tribes to go through, we have different styles, for example, of prayer. The Sephardim don't pray in exactly the way as the Ashkenazim do. This is normative in Judaism. We know that when it comes to the practice of Judaism, Judaism is pretty much unified. For example, our dietary laws are our dietary laws. The Sabbath is the Sabbath, in terms of our practice. But in terms of how we understand Judaism, there isn't one way in which Judaism can be explained and understood. So for example, in the phylacteries, in the tefillin that are worn, the tefillin on the arm is composed of one compartment. It's just one compartment, because what we do, our action, is pretty much, that's it. There's only one real practice in some ways. That's not even, that's an oversimplification as well. But when it comes to the practice of Judaism, we're pretty much unified. But when it comes to the head tefillin, the one on the head, which is our understanding of what we do, there are four separate compartments. It's not one compartment. There are four separate compartments with four separate pieces of parchment. Because our understanding of Judaism is not one dimension. We can have different ways of explaining the same exact practice. For example, what do the dietary laws mean? You might read books and there might be 20 different explanations of what the dietary laws mean, or the Sabbath. And over history, these understandings could also change. Maimonides would probably write about many things in Judaism differently than we would explain these ideas 8 centuries later. The Zohar tells us, the famous Kabbalistic work, that Shivim Panim LaTorah. There are 70 faces to the Torah. Right? The Torah is not one-dimensional. The Torah has many, many different facets and aspects and ways of looking at it. So we have to understand at the outset tonight that Judaism, at its core, recognizes that we don't have to all be the same. Then we have a famous passage in the Talmud. The Talmud says that the students of Hillel said that the law is according to our opinion. The students of Shammai said, no, the law is according to our opinion. They disagreed. What happened? The Talmud says a bat kol, a heavenly voice, came down and said, Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim, that these and these are both the words of the living God. It's a very radical idea. The fact that two different opposing points of view can both be legitimate, can both be true. Right? In most ways of thinking, if two people disagree, right, they can't both be right. The famous Jewish joke, right? The rabbi is coming to settle an argument, and the rabbi says to the first guy, you're right, and he says to the second guy, you're also right. And someone comes to the rabbi and says, how could they both be right? And the rabbi says, you're also right. So the Talmud has something very radical here. The principle of elu ve'elu, these and these, right, even though they're different and they disagree, and they're mutually exclusive to both the words of the living God. The Talmud goes on, however, to say that the practice of Judaism normally follows the school of Hillel. Even though both points of view are legitimate, right, we've got to do something, we have to decide in one way or the other, so the Talmud says that we practice like the school of Hillel. Why? Why Hillel? So the Talmud says because Hillel's school, the students were humble, they were gentle, and they would study their opponent's position, they'd study the teachings of Shammai as well as their own teachings, meaning that even though they disagreed with Shammai very, very strongly, they wanted to understand that point of view, and they even quoted their opponent's point of view before they quoted their own point of view, meaning that they were seekers of truth, and they didn't simply dismiss other points of view, they wanted to engage them, and because Hillel had that kind of a perspective where they really were considering everything, we follow their perspective. This is fascinating. Mishnah in Brachot, the first tractate of the Talmud, which asks the question, from what time can we say the Shema, right, the famous prayer Shema Yisrael, from what time can we say the Shema in the morning? Right, we know that every mitzvah, every commandment has parameters. If you eat matzah today, you don't fulfill the commandment of eating matzah on Passover. If you blow the shofar today, it doesn't help you with the Rosh Hashanah. So when we are asked to read the Shema in the evening, the question is, what time does the evening begin? So the Mishnah asks the same question, from what time can you read the Shema in the morning? What is the earliest time? So the Mishnah says, when you see your friend at a distance of more than Dalet Amos, about 6 feet, when you see your friend at a distance of more than 6 feet, and you're able to recognize him. So Rabbi Saul Weiss explains this Mishnah in a homiletic way. He says, when it asks the question, when can you say the Shema, it's really asking, when can you really consider yourself to be a spiritual Jew? Meaning, when are you able to have a relationship with God? When are you able to really place yourself in the realm of Jewish spirituality? And the Mishnah says, when you see someone that lies beyond your Dalet Amos. Dalet Amos is an expression in Talmud, meaning your realm, your area. So when you see someone who's outside of your particular personal philosophical realm, they're not in your ballpark, and you still recognize them, you still grant the legitimacy of their point of view, even though it's not your point of view, then you can have a relationship with God. The Midrash says, the rabbis teach us that when God was about to create man, so the angels got together and they paired up, and they began arguing. Some of the angels were in favor of creating man, and some of the angels were opposed. There was a big debate going on. So the angel of kindness, Chesed, said, yes, create human beings, they're going to do lots of kindness. But then the angel of truth came and said, don't create human beings, they're full of lies, they're a bunch of liars. Then the angel of righteousness came and said, sure, you should create human beings because they can be righteous. And then the angel of peace came, Shalom, and said, no, don't create them, they always fight. So here you have a tie, two against two, what do you do? So the Midrash says that God broke the tie by taking the angel of truth and throwing it to the ground. Now you have two against one in favor of creating man. But when God took truth and threw it to the ground, the angels complained to God and said, look, God, you took your beautiful jewel, right? We say, Hashem Elokeichem Emet. Truth is the seal of God, considered the signet ring of God. And the angel said, you took your beautiful jewel, your crowned jewel, your signet ring, and you threw it to the ground, you degraded it. So God says to the angels, no. By throwing it to the ground, God says, truth will now spring forth from the earth. Rabbi Cardozo explains this midrash by saying the following. By throwing truth down to the ground, God basically shatters it into many pieces. And he says that just as light, white light, when it's refracted through a prism, breaks up into many, many colors, right? And these colors are different, and they're mutually exclusive. So too, truth breaks up into many different facets. And even though these facets of truth seem mutually exclusive, like the different colors of a spectrum, in reality, each one of these aspects of truth reflects just one hue of its original light. Meaning that ultimately, all of these pieces of truth that to us seem like they can't exist together, they seem like they contradict, ultimately they all come from the same place, and they're all resolvable. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, one of the great halachic authorities of the previous century, he said that the Torah we have is so complex that any time you probe any issue in the Torah, it will yield disagreements. The nature of the Torah is that it's so complex that any analysis of any topic will yield, by necessity, disagreements. And he says that the fact that it yields disagreements reflects the divine wisdom of the Torah. He says that because it's so complex, he says it's beyond ultimate human comprehension. It's not a human product, it's a divine product. Since it's a divine product, we can never totally understand it, and therefore we will always disagree in our trying to read the Torah. So that only debate, he says, expresses the fullness of the Torah. I want to share with you an illustration, a story that illustrates this principle of Elu Ve'elu. These and these are words of the living God. In the 1940s, Rabbi Schussheim, he became a lecturer at Yeshiva University when I was a student there in the 1970s. So Rabbi Schussheim was a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik in the 1940s. And often students would have to take a synagogue placement over the high holidays to make some money. So he came to Rabbi Soloveitchik and asked for help. He needed some help, I guess, some schlep, you know, a few contacts, and you get him a job. So Rabbi Soloveitchik asked Rabbi Schussheim, would you like to go to a synagogue that has a mechitza, or would you like to go to a synagogue that doesn't have a mechitza? Rabbi Schussheim was flustered. He couldn't believe it. Because he knew that, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, it was prohibited to pray in a synagogue without a mechitza, even on the high holidays. Meaning Rabbi Soloveitchik said that if you can't go to a synagogue with a mechitza, he said it's better to pray at home. So he couldn't understand, why is Rabbi Soloveitchik offering me the option of taking a position in a synagogue without a mechitza? Now, of course, if you think back to the 1940s, there were probably many, many more places available that didn't have a mechitza, and they actually paid more money. So Rabbi Soloveitchik basically said that even though I maintain that it's prohibited to pray in a synagogue without a mechitza, Rabbi Soloveitchik knew that there were other rabbis who disagreed. And since there were different points of view, he wanted to give his student the option, right, of taking a synagogue without a mechitza. Meaning that here is someone who acknowledges, right, that even though there's a point of view with I disagree strongly, he didn't feel that he had to impose this on his student, right? He wanted his student to have the full range of options. They tell a famous story about the Apter Rebbe. The Apter Rebbe was a famous Hasidic Rebbe. He wrote a famous book called the Ohev Shalom, The Lover of Peace. And he was very famous because he always taught about the importance of shalom bayit, of having peace in the house and having peace among the Jewish people. And he taught his students that every single chapter of the Bible, every parasha, right, that we read on Shabbat, he said every parasha has a lesson of shalom bayit, of peace in the home. So one particular week, the student said to him, Rebbe, you know, we don't see it in this week's chapter. We don't see in this week's Torah reading where you have a lesson for shalom bayit, for peace in the home. So he says to the students, you don't see it? It's in the title of the parsha. It's in the very title. That week happened to be Parshat Balak. And they said to him, where do you see any teaching about having peace in the home in the name Balak? So he says, what, are you kidding? He says, Balak. The letter is Balak. Beis Lamed Kuf. It stands for, it's an abbreviation for Ve'ahavta L'Re'echa Kamocha. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. So the students look at him and they say, what are you talking about? Ve'ahavta is spelled with a vav, not with a bet. Right? Because you have two letters in Hebrew that can make the V sound. Balak begins with a bet. Ve'ahavta is with a vav. And kamocha is with a chaf, not with a kuf. So he says to his students, you see, if everything has to be exactly perfect, you're never going to have shalom bayit. Right? You have to have some flexibility. You have to be able to be a little bit flexible. So one of the criteria, one of the things that's critical for us to be able to get along, is that we can't be so fastidious with having everything our way and requiring that we always be comfortable. We have to have a certain amount of flexibility. I want to share with you an incredible passage from the Talmud. It's a passage from Tractate Brachot, the first tractate in the Talmud. And the Talmud here raises a contradiction between two verses. The Talmud's bothered. It seems that there are two verses that seem to contradict. Amru Malachei Hasharet Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The angels, the ministering angels, came before God and they said, Ribono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Katuv B'Toratecha, it's written in your Torah, Asher Lo Yisab Panim V'Lo Yikach Shochad. You write in your Torah that we shouldn't show favor to one party in a court case, V'Lo Yikach Shochad, and you shall not accept a bribe. This is when God's instruction to us. Don't show favoritism. For example, let's say there's a court case and there's a handsome person on trial and a person that's not so handsome. You shouldn't favor the one that's handsome, or you shouldn't favor the one that's rich. Right? Everyone must be treated the same. And then God says, and don't take a bribe. So the angels say, this is what your Torah says, God. Don't show favoritism. However, the hello, they say, God, isn't it true? Ata no se panim l'Yisrael. You show favoritism to the Jewish people. Dichsiv, as it says in the Birchat Kohanim, in the priestly benediction that we say in outside of Israel on the holidays, inside of Israel on every day, we say in the book of Numbers, Yisa Hashem Panav Elecha, God will show favoritism to you. He'll show his face, he'll lift up his face to you. The angels caught God in a contradiction, right? They said to God, look, God, you said we shouldn't show favoritism. But in the Bible it says you will show favoritism to the Jewish people. So Amar Lahem, so God says to the angels, V'chi lo esa panim l'Israel, how can I not show favoritism to the Jewish people? How can I not be so nice to them? Why? Shekasati lahem b'Torah, I wrote for them in the Torah, V'achalta v'savata u'beirachta es Hashem Elokecha. You shall eat and you shall be satiated and then you shall thank God. Meaning, the Torah tells us we have to say Birkat HaMazon, we have to say the grace after meals. When? When you're satiated, meaning when you're full. Right? Then you eat and you have to become full and then you have to say Birkat HaMazon. So God says, that's what I commanded them. V'heim medaktikim al atzman, but they are very strict upon themselves, and they will say the Birkat HaMazon even if they only have a kazayin, an olive's worth, or a kebeya, or an X volume. Meaning that I only require they say Birkat HaMazon if they have so much food that they feel stuffed and full. They'll thank me even though they only have a little bit. So God says, how can I not be nice to them? How can I not show favoritism to them? So the commentaries try to understand, why is it this? Why is it this that somehow forces God to show his favor to us? So Rabbi Yaakov Ornstein, he wrote a very famous book called The Yeshua's Yaakov. He tries to explain it with a Mishnah, also in Tractate Brachot, where they discuss the idea of Zimun. Zimun means that if there's three people eat together, they're supposed to join together and invite each other to say the Birkat HaMazon. They don't just say it by themselves as individuals, they should get together as a group. So the Mishnah discusses how much food do they have to eat in order to require them to join together as a group, as a Zimun of three. So there are two opinions. Rabbi Meir says they have to have a kazayin. They have to have an olives volume of food. And Rabbi Yehuda says they have to have an eggs volume. So Rabbi Yaakov Ornstein said that, you know what happened? Let's say there was a group of people that were a mixture of students from both schools. Let's say there were students of Rabbi Yehuda and there were students of Rabbi Meir. So what would they do when they had a meal together? They had different points of view in terms of what amount they would have to eat in order to get together and require them to say Zimun. So you know what they would do? They would agree ahead of time either to eat less than a kazayit, in which case everyone agreed, both their teachers agreed they didn't have to get together as a Zimun, or they would all agree that they would eat more than a kebeya, more than an X volume, in which case everyone would agree they had to get together. Meaning that they showed consideration for the opinion of people with whom they disagreed in order to work things out. Meaning the fact that they disagreed and the fact that they had different opinions didn't prevent them from working together and trying to make some kind of a consensus where they would work out an agreement where they can live together and everyone's opinion can be somehow respected. So Rabbi Yaakov Ornstein said, you see, if the Jewish people are going to be like that, meaning that they are going to, in some ways, go beyond their own personal point of view and give legitimacy to the point of view of other people and take other people's point of view into consideration and grant other people's point of view legitimacy, and they're going to play nicely together, God says, how can I not show favoritism to such people? The question at this point is, I've been discussing so far, how do we relate to people within our camp? Meaning that, how do we relate to people that we disagree, but basically we acknowledge that they are within the pale of Judaism. Right? We don't have any major problems with their point of view. The more delicate question that I'd like to just discuss at this point is, what do we do with people who lie outside of what we think is legitimate Jewishly? We can't accept it. It's not something which we can ever say carries any legitimacy within Judaism. So we know that the Torah has a very famous teaching in the book of Leviticus, chapter 19, verse 17. The Torah says, don't hate your brother in your heart. Don't hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor. Hochegach tochiach et amitecha. You shall surely rebuke. I guess the Torah uses this word twice. It doubles up. Hochegach tochiach. Not just rebuke, but sort of rebuke. So that's often translated, you shall surely rebuke your neighbor. And then don't bear sin because of him. Three phrases. Don't hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor, and don't bear sin because of him. Some of the commentaries explain that what this really means is that when you rebuke your neighbor, what you're doing is really entering into a dialogue with your neighbor. Right? There may be something which you feel they're doing is totally inappropriate. But maybe you don't understand. Maybe they haven't explained their point of view. Maybe they can justify it. Maybe they'll be corrected. So the commentaries explain that by giving them rebuke, you're beginning to enter into a dialogue where you begin to discuss, what are they doing? What do they believe? Maybe you'll be able to convince them they're wrong. Maybe they'll be able to convince you that their point of view is somehow acceptable. But when you do this, when you get involved with this kind of a dialogue, you can begin to understand the other person, and then you won't come to hate them. Meaning that the verse here is saying, don't hate your brother in your heart, rather, engage them in rebuke. And if you engage them in rebuke, you won't bear sin on account of them. Meaning, the sin will be if you begin to hate them because you didn't give them the opportunity to explain themselves. Some of the Hasidic masters discuss why the verse here doubles the word hocheach tochiach. Why does it say, you shall rebuke, you shall rebuke? Why does it repeat that word? So this Fas Emes, the second Ger Rebbe, said, the reason is because each one of us has to take responsibility when someone else does the wrong thing. But if you see someone doing the wrong thing or believing the wrong thing, the Fas Emes says that we ourselves need to take responsibility because we're all one family. We're all one people. And if there are people that are doing the wrong thing, it's partially because I wasn't doing a good enough job to explain things and teach people. Meaning that in some way, the people who are on the right track bear responsibility for their neighbors. And so this Fas Emes says, Hocheach Tochiach, right? You yourself have to be rebuked. You have to include yourself in the rebuke. Even when you have to come and rebuke someone else, part of that rebuke goes on yourself, because you yourself bear responsibility. We're told that when we give rebuke, we have to do it intelligently. You know, when the Jewish people went into the first exile to Babylon, we know that there was a tremendous problem with intermarriage. Many of the Jewish men married Babylonian women. And when they came back to Israel in the times of Ezra and Nehemiah, these two great men had to rebuke the Jews. It wasn't proper for them to be married to non-Jewish women. But they rebuked them intelligently, meaning they could have screamed at them, you know, divorce your wives, how can you be married to a non-Jewish woman? You know, they could have directly attacked the people. They didn't do that. They understood that to go for the jugular in a direct way, it's not going to help. Right? People are going to become defensive. People are going to react. People are not going to appreciate it. So do you know what Ezra and Nehemiah did when the Jews came back from Babylon? They didn't give sermons from the synagogue about intermarriage. They didn't talk about intermarriage. They spoke about the importance of Shabbat. That's all they spoke about. Because they understood that if they can strengthen people's connection to Judaism, right, that somehow that will have a ripple effect. And if these people can increase and improve their relationship with God and their relationship with Judaism, they'll get to the point where either they will decide that their wives need to convert, or they'll realize that if these women don't want to convert, we can't stay married because I'm someone who's very committed to Judaism. But they understood that when you're going to reprove people, you've got to do it with seichel, you have to do it with intelligence, and often you have to do it indirectly. The truth of the matter is that tochacha, rebuke, doesn't always apply. For example, Maimonides writes in his Laws of Heretics, he's got a whole section of laws dealing with heretics, he says that there are times when we do consider people outside the fold. In the times of Maimonides, he was writing about the Karaites. The Karaites were a whole group of Jews who denied the existence and the reality of the oral Torah. They said that God only gave the written Torah at Mount Sinai, and they completely disregarded the Talmud and the oral Torah. So from Maimonides' point of view, that's outside of the camp. That's not legitimate from a Jewish point of view. So he said that the Karaites, we can't engage them, right? They have to be basically shunned. But he said, what about the children of the Karaites? Meaning that, what about kids who were raised as Karaites? They didn't break away from Judaism. They didn't rebel against Judaism. This is just what they were raised with. They don't know any better. So Maimonides gives the principle that we don't have to rebuke people who we can't really hold responsible. As a matter of fact, when you rebuke such people, you're just going to push them away. And many of the commentaries point out that rebuke only applies to people in your particular camp. Meaning, people that you share values with, people that you have common ground with, you can rebuke them because you have a common level of understanding. But people who don't accept the basic parameters of Judaism that you live by, you don't have any business rebuking them. It's not going to help, and it's really going to do the exact opposite. You're going to push these people further away. So the question is, what do you do with people that you can't rebuke? Meaning you have Jews that, as far as you're concerned, here, you know, every summer for the last 25 years, I've been going to the Jews for Jesus conferences in the United States, right? Major conferences with 1,000 or 2,000 Jews for Jesus. None of us accept the legitimacy of what they're doing, right? Do I go there to rebuke them? Do I come there with a big Talmud and I say, look, you sinners, right? You got to get repentance. You got to get your act together. No, because it's not, these are not people in my camp, right? I can only, you know, rebuke people who I have a common level of understanding with. So the Balat Tanya, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, writes that for those people who are not part of your community, for those people who you can't rebuke, the mitzvah is to love them. That's the mitzvah, is to love them. There's a famous story where someone came to the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, and he said, look, Rebbe, my son is like totally off the path. My son is a sinner, he's rebelling, he doesn't listen to me, doesn't follow the Torah, doesn't observe any of the mitzvot, he's totally gone. So the Baal Shem Tov said to the father, you have to love him then even more. That's the approach to such people. You have to love them even more. One of the most daring Hasidic Rebbes, the Ishbitzer Rebbe, says something that's critical in terms of our position and stance, just in terms of the way we react to the rest of the world. He says that when the Torah was given, when the Ten Commandments were given at Mount Sinai, what's the first of the Ten Commandments? So the first of the Ten Commandments is where God says, I am the Lord your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt from the house of slavery. God introduces himself, right? I'm God. And the implication is that you should believe in me. What is the Hebrew word for I, for me? What's the Hebrew word for I, or me? Ani. Ani, right? That's the normal Hebrew word. Ani. I wrote, ani rotze, I want. Ani ohev, I love. Right? Ani, that's the word all of us know. The Ten Commandments doesn't begin by God saying, Ani, I am the Lord your God. It says, Anochi. It's a very unusual word. No one in Hebrew today, if you go to Israel, you know, is going to say, Anochi rotzeh, I want. You know, it's not a word that's used. It's almost never used. Anochi, it's an unusual word. So the Ishbitzer Rebbe, the Meshiloach, writes, why did God introduce himself by saying, Anochi? And not Ani. Because the word Anochi is the word Ani with the Chaf HaDimyon, the letter Chaf of similitude. Meaning that the letter Chaf in Hebrew is like Kimo, like. So what God is saying is not I am the Lord your God. God is saying like Ke'ilu. It's like I am like God. Meaning that according to the Ishbitzer Rebbe, what God is trying to teach us here is, don't think that I can ever fully communicate myself to you. Don't think that I am so easy to understand that you can wrap your head around me and say that you totally and fully understand who God is or what God is. So what we're taught here is that our knowledge is never perfect. Our knowledge is always ke'ilu. It's, we have a, somehow we can approximate what the truth is. And that's why the Meshiloach says that right after this commandment to believe in God, it says, don't make for yourself any graven images. He says what that means is, a graven image is something that you can define, it's cut out, its parameters are very neatly, right, defined. He says, when you begin to think that the truth is so easy to grasp, and so clear and so well delineated, he says, that's idolatry. So the first thing we have to remember is that we need to have an attitude of humility. It's not so simple that I have the truth and you're a heretic. Because you really have the truth? I know everything perfectly well? So one of the most critical attitudes to have, even though we can feel and we can say that we understand that someone else is wrong, it has to be tinged with a bit of humility. Rabbi Yitzhak Greenberg used to always say, I don't care what denomination you belong to, as long as you're ashamed of it. I don't care, you know, as long as you don't think that you're perfect, as long as you don't think that, you know, everything is so smooth. Nothing is smooth. Everything has its problems. And ultimately, we have to be patient with people. Right? This humility has to lead us to be very patient with people. There's a very beautiful story that's told about this town in Russia where they had a very corrupt official. It was the town was policeman, who back then was not just a policeman, he was the tax collector, and he was the judge, and he did everything. He was like the guy that ran the city. A small little town in Russia. So he would basically, he would just steal all the money that he collected in taxes. He would just take it for himself. So one day he gets a letter from St. Petersburg. Says, you know, you haven't given any of the back taxes. You owe us 30,000 rubles. So this guy has a heart attack. He can't believe it. 30,000 rubles. What am I going to do? He doesn't have 30,000 rubles. So he does what they all did back then. They need any money. He went and he kidnapped a Jewish kid, right? He went out, the first Jewish person he sees, he kidnaps him, he holds him for ransom, and he says to the people in the town, you want this guy back? I need 30,000 rubles. So the whole city gets together, and they're so upset because, you know, they realize that they're a poor town, and they realize that all the money they have, everything they have, they sold everything, and they took all their cash. They don't have more than 5,000 rubles. They don't have anything near 30,000 rubles. So at this time, when they were having this meeting, there happened to be three young rabbis who would become great rabbis in the future. It's a true story. One was Rav Menachem of Vitebsk. One was Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. And one was Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev. These three great rebbis, they were young men at this time, and they're listening to the town deliberating. And the Balatanya, who became the first Lubavitcher Rebbe later on, he says, you know what, I have an idea. He says, isn't there a guy who lives on the outskirts of the town, that's like a gazillionaire? Isn't there that guy that's very, very wealthy? So they say, are you crazy? He's a Mishumud. He converted to Christianity. He doesn't want anything to do with us. He hates us. And anyone that's tried to go to him for help in the past, he would threaten to shoot them. So the Balatanya said, yeah, but you know what? He's the only one that has the money. It's got to be him. So his friends say, I don't know, it's a risky idea. He says, well, I'm going. So his friends say, listen, if you're going to go, we're going to go with you. So he says, on the one condition, he says, if we go there, I do all the talking, you guys keep your mouth shut. So they go out to the edge of the town, go to this big palace, this big castle, they knock on the door. And this guy comes out with his fancy night coat or whatever, and he can't believe what he sees. Three rabbis standing at his door. He says to them, are you guys crazy for coming here? I would normally kill people like you. So the Balatanya says, listen, I have to tell you something. He says, we have a terrible emergency because the police officer kidnapped this young man. This young man was supposed to get married tomorrow. His wedding was tomorrow. And he was an orphan. This young boy is an orphan. Didn't have parents. And he was raised as a ward of the whole city. We all supported him. We raised him. And he was set to get married tomorrow. And if he doesn't get married, the whole shidduch might fall apart and his whole life might be destroyed. You got to help us. We need 25,000 rubles. So he says, you know, I don't know. You know, and he makes a big plea and he starts begging. He says, listen, you know, this person's life's going to be destroyed. It's an orphan. Have a little bit of rahmanis. Anyway, after pleading for 10 minutes, this wealthy, wealthy man says, all right, fine. I'm going to help. So he goes to the next room. There's a big desk, a huge desk. He opens the top drawer and he pulls out a coin. And he throws it to the rabbi. It's basically a kopeck. It's a little penny. a rusty, dirty old kopek. So the rabbi picks it up, and his two friends are looking, and they're so enraged that he had the chutzpah to give you a penny. So they're about to open their mouths, and the palatani says, I told you, you know, you guys keep your mouth shut, I'm going to do the talking. So he says to this gvir, to this wealthy man, he says, I got to thank you so much. This is so wonderful what you've done. It breaks my heart that you were so helpful. And I want to thank you, and I want to give you a blessing. And it's so important. You're helping so much. It's the greatest thing in the world. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. But you know what? It's wonderful that you gave us this money, but we need 25,000 rubles. Anyway, he goes on and on and on. And finally, the guy says, all right, fine. So he goes into the room again, and he throws him another dirty message. So this time the two friends are going nuts. They want to wring this guy by the neck. And he says, I told you, be quiet. So again he thanks him. Oh, thank you so much. This is great. It's so wonderful. You're so kind. It's so, you know, I can't thank you enough. It's so amazing what you've done. But, you know, we still need 25,000 rubles. Anyway, the guy goes into the room and now he gives him 5 rubles. He goes up a lot. And then he comes back half hour later, gives him 10, and then 100, and then 1,000. Then after a couple of hours, they get to 25,000 rubles. So they go to the police officer, they give him the 25,000 rubles, and he's like blown away. He can't believe he's got the money now. He frees the young man. They put together the wedding. And this guy makes a party for himself. He says, 25,000 rubles? I'm not going to give it to St. Petersburg. I'm keeping it for myself. So he gets drunk as a skunk and he's having a big party and he decides he's got to get out of there though. He can't stay there. So he gets into his horse and he gives the horse a whip and he starts taking off. Meanwhile, there's a big wedding going on and this wealthy, wealthy man, you know, he felt good about the fact that he was able to help this couple. So he went to the wedding. And they're dancing at the wedding, and as they're having this big celebration, the cop, the police officer is going over the bridge to get out of town, and he's so drunk that he crashes into the bridge. He goes flying out of the wagon, he drowns in the river, and the collision caused the money to go flying in the other direction. The money flies and lands up right at the feet of the wealthy man at the wedding. So he picks up his money, and he says, you know what, I want to give it to you guys. He gives it to the bride and groom. Anyway, it's a cute story. But while this is going on, Rav Nachum Mendel of Vitebsk and Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev are talking with their friend, Shneur Zalman of Liadi. And they say to him, how did you know what to do in there? You were able to get the 25,000 rubles. How did you know how to deal with this guy? So he says to them, do you remember that when we first asked him for the money, he took out a dirty, old, rusty coin and threw it at us? They said, yeah. He said, do you think that's the first time he tried giving that money to anyone? That's why it was so old and rusty. He tried giving away that penny many, many, many times. And you know what happened? People took it and they threw it back in his face. You know, the problem was that no one was willing to accept what he was able to give. They said, Nebuch, this poor guy, even though he's loaded, he couldn't give more than a penny. That's all he could give. And he said, all I needed to do was, I was willing to accept that which he was able to do. And once I was able to accept what he was able to give, I was able to encourage him to give more. So the problem is, when we expect other people to be just like we want them to be, we don't really have much of a chance of living together in peace and in harmony. We have to learn, in some levels, to accept what people are able to do. I once had a friend that was beginning to observe Shabbat. He was someone, he must have been already out of university, and he was dating someone that converted to Judaism. She was already Shomeret Shabbat. But she was dating this fellow, a very brilliant young man. And they were going to spend Shabbat with me when I was living in New Jersey at the time. So she was already at my house. And I get a call from him from Manhattan. It's a half hour before Shabbat. I'm living in New Jersey. So he said to me, what do I do? So he can't get from Manhattan to my house in a half hour. So I said, listen, I said, if it was me, I told him, I said, if it was me, right, in your situation now, I would try to get to the nearest synagogue and try to get the rabbi to let me crash there for Shabbat. That's what I would do if it was me. If I found myself in Manhattan a half hour before Shabbat, I would try and just get invited to someone's house for Shabbat. That's what I would try to do. I knew he wouldn't do that. I knew he wouldn't do that. I said, if you can't do that, if you can't do that, I said, try going home. Because he had a chance of getting home to Brooklyn within a half hour. Not a good chance, but it was possible he could go home. I suspected he wouldn't do that either, because he wanted to be with his girlfriend. So I said, and if you can't do that, so then try and come here. Right? But I knew who I was dealing with. He wasn't someone who had become Shomer Shabbat. He was basically in the process of. He was sort of struggling with it. He was, you know, not fully there. So if I expect him to live the way I would live, we're not going to get anywhere with this guy. If I told him, look, go home, or, you know, don't bother coming here, stay away. Beyond this, it's critical that we learn how to overlook stereotypes, look beyond the superficial, and open ourselves up to the possibility that there's goodness in other people. I want to share with you a wonderful story from Rabbi Shlomo Carlebach. There's a wonderful book about him called Holy Brother. So they write, 10 years ago, Chaya Adler, who was a new congregant of the synagogue, of his synagogue in Manhattan, she met Shlomo Carlebach near a subway station on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. After a few moments of animated discussion, Shlomo said to her with a mischievous twinkle in his eye, Holy Sister Chaya, I'm on my way to meet a Hasidic man who works in the Diamond District. If you're not busy and have the time, I'd be so honored if you would please accompany me, he says to her. Chaya looked at Shlomo in shock and surprise. Rav Shlomo, she stammered, I'd love to come along, but I don't want to offend the Hasidic men in the Diamond District. As you can see, I'm not dressed properly. I don't think my skirt's long enough. Don't worry, Sister Chaya, Shlomo tried to soothe her. You have such a holy Jewish face, no one will even notice your skirt, he says to her. Certain she would encounter a sea of hostility if she ventured into the Hasidic enclave, Chaya valiantly tried to extricate herself from the expedition. But curiously, the more she explained to Shlomo why she couldn't accompany him, the more insistent he became that she do so. Before long, Shlomo allayed Chaya's fears, and she joined him on the IRT subway downtown. As soon as Shlomo hit 47th Street, he was encircled by throngs of Hasidic admirers. Awkwardly, Chaya tried to stand unobtrusively on the side, but each time she made an effort to slip away unnoticed, Shlomo deliberately drew her back to his side and announced to the men, Everybody, you should meet my sweetest friend, Holy Sister Chai. Do you know that she is an outstanding scholar and learns Hasidic literature brilliantly? Each time Shlomo made this and similar announcements to the men, Chaya thought she would die of embarrassment. She was sure that the men would regard her with scorn and derision and greet Shlomo's statement with a patronizing sneer. Instead, to her amazement, they were respectful. They were friendly, and they were curious, and they were open. They politely inquired as to which holy book she was studying, and were intrigued to learn that she was currently immersed in the esoteric teachings of the Ishbitzer Rebbe. Up and down 47th Street, the interactions were unexpectedly the same, positive and upbeat. Having braced herself for trouble, Chaya was not only relieved, but pleasantly surprised. Returning to the Upper West Side in a bemused and contemplative state, Chaya suddenly had an epiphany. It was only upon my return home that I realized that Shlomo, who never wasted an opportunity to perform an act of loving kindness or impart a moral message, had deliberately choreographed the entire encounter. When he saw me near the subway, He seized the occasion to combine his visit to the Diamond District with the opportunity to deliver an important teaching. The teaching, directed both at me and the Hasidim we met, was quite clearly the importance of letting go of conventional stereotypes. On that fateful day, both they and I learned a valuable lesson: to suspend judgment and look beyond dress and appearance for the divine spark that resides in each soul. From that day forward, I began to look at Hasidim as individuals, not as stereotypes. I'm equally certain that their own perception of modern Jewish women have altered perceptibly as a result of our exchange and would never quite be the same again. In very, very difficult circumstances, there are people who manage to carry on relationships with people who you wouldn't imagine they could relate to. One of the greatest heretics in Jewish history was Elisha ben Avuya. Elisha ben Avuya was the Rebbe of Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir was one of the greatest rabbis in the entire Talmud. And unfortunately, his rabbi, Elisha ben Avuya, became a heretic, a total heretic. You would think that Rabbi Meir would basically cut his relationship with his teacher, but he didn't. He continued to learn and to study with Elisha ben Avuya. So he was challenged. They said to him, "How do you study with such a person? He's a heretic." Rabbi Meir said, "I chew the fruit and I spit out the pit." Right? I'm able to use my discretion and my discernment in terms of what I learned from this person. But I don't just reject him entirely. Ultimately, we need to take our lead from God. The Bible tells us that God is tolerant, and our requirement as Jews is to imitate God. One of the most famous Kabbalistic books ever written is called The Palm Tree of Deborah, the Tomer Devorah. And in the first chapter of the Tomer Devorah, the author of Moshe Cordovero writes that if you think about God and how much He tolerates, it's incredible. He says, for example, at the very moment that someone is sinning against God, a person could be committing a horrible crime. Who is giving life to that person's limbs? Who is animating that person's life? So we see that God puts up with and tolerates an incredible amount of very, very aggravating behavior. And so, can we be any less than God? Right, for us to basically take a position where we write people off, we reject them forever, that's not what God would do. I want to conclude with one final teaching, and that's from the first chief rabbi of Mandatory Palestine, Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook. Rav Cook was someone whose teaching on tolerance were radical. Rav Cook, for example, had to deal with the Chalutzim, the pioneers in the land of Israel, who were not only not religious, they were anti-religious. So how did the chief rabbi deal with these people that are anti-religious in the land of Israel? So his position was that, you know what, despite all their religious beliefs and disbeliefs, these are people that are doing something incredibly important. They're helping resettle the Jewish homeland. They're helping rebuild the Jewish homeland. And they're doing it with tremendous self-sacrifice. And they're doing it, and there are many religious Jews who are not doing it. So he realized that just like Rabbi Meir was able to take what was valuable from his teacher and basically push everything else off to the side, Rav Cook was able to value the contributions of these chalutzim, and he wasn't bothered by the fact that they were anti-religious. In a famous story, there was a great rabbi in Israel whose son became a communist. So Rabbi Cook encouraged this rabbi. Rabbi Cook said to the rabbi, "You should still stay very close to your son. Maintain a very, very close relationship." He said that your son, unfortunately, has been swept along with the tide of history. Right? Communism, socialism, they were incredibly powerful social movements. And even though your son wasn't raised as a communist, Maimonides said that the people who were raised as Karaites, you can have more tolerance for them, right? A person who becomes a Karaite from Judaism, you shouldn't. But Rav Cook goes farther, and he says, even though this kid was raised in a religious home, he knew the difference between right and wrong, it's not his fault. The social winds are so powerful, your son was swept up in them. And he went on to tell the father, and think about it. Your son is very idealistic. Your son is really someone who wants to do good. He's not trying to be an evil person. He has ideals and he's dedicated to making the world into a better place. You have to have some tolerance for your son. Finally, Rav Kook said, based upon the teachings of the Kabbalah, that everything in the world that exists has some divine spark that animates it. If something had no divine spark, no spark of divinity, it would cease to exist entirely. The fact that it exists, Rav Kook said, is evidence that deep down inside there's something holy in it, even though it might be something that's totally untrue. And so Rav Kook said that our job is to try to appreciate, try to get in touch with, try to clarify what is that spark of holiness inside those people who have gone so far away from Judaism. It says in Pirkei Avot, who is the wise person? The wise person is the one that can learn from everyone. And so I believe that if we're to live as a Jewish community with Ahavat Yisrael, with love for our fellow Jews, and to live with unity, to live together in peace, I think that we have to embrace these teachings of Judaism, these teachings of our Holy Torah that speak about having an attitude of tolerance, of love, of humility, of sensing that really deep down inside people are ultimately good, they want to do good, and that hopefully if we engage them properly, we have a chance of maybe helping them see that they can improve, or at least be able to live with them in peace.